Hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBeer, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So, Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, I can't even believe it. Today we are chatting with Jay Wright, former coach of Villanova University's men's championship basketball team and current council member of UBS's America's Advisory Council.
Gang, Jess and I traveled all the way to New York City for our first ever in-person, professionally recorded podcast taping. You're going to want to see how this turned out. Go to our website and check it out. For now, let's find out who's stopping by today.
Okay, folks, we have quite the get for you today on the Stopping By podcast as Doug and I are chatting with an absolute legend in the college basketball world. Stopping by today is the former head coach of Villanova University's basketball team, Coach Jay Wright. Yay!
What's up, guys? Great to be with you guys.
We are delighted to have you here today. Coach Jay Wright had an incredibly successful career spanning 30 years at various Division I basketball programs. He guided his beloved Wildcats to two NCAA national championships and four appearances in the NCAA Final Four. And in January of 2020, was named the Associated Press Men's College Basketball Coach of the Decade. The following year, he was forever enshrined in the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. He even won a gold medal with the USA basketball team at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. Come on! His New York Times best-selling book, Attitude, was published in 2017. And in 2018, Coach Wright received the John R. Wooden Legends of Coaching Award in Los Angeles. He is also a two-time winner of the Naismith National Coach of the Year Award, and in 2018-19 became the first man in Big East history to be selected as the league's Coach of the Year six times. In April of 2022, Jay announced his retirement from coaching and transitioned into a new role at Villanova as special assistant to President Peter Donahue. He also currently serves on UBS's America's Advisory Council as an invaluable resource to clients and colleagues, and he guides us on leadership principles and is contributing towards the growth of our sports and entertainment segments. Of course, you can also see Jay on TV as a studio and game analyst for, as a studio and game analyst for CBS Sports through the college basketball season. Doug, I could go on and on and on about this guy. All right, but I want to dive into the meat and potatoes. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, Coach Jay Wright. Snaps.
Thank you, guys. We give snaps for
that.
We do snaps. Welcome. Yeah, welcome. Good to be here with you all.
Oh, my gosh. It's wonderful to have you. And I know that you're on tap to ask the first question, but I have a burning question because I just have to know this. When I went to college, I'm a tall drink of water. I'm 6 feet tall. When I went to college, they lovingly nicknamed me Kareem.
Nice.
They did. And I had to look it up. I didn't know what it was. So my question is, did you have a college nickname?
I did. J-Bones.
J-Bones.
Yeah, that was my college. They still call me that. My kids have heard my college buddies call me Bones, and now my kids are calling me Bones. And I think when I have a grandchild, it's
Grandpa Bones.
They're probably going to call
Bones.
Me. They might even go Bones. I'm afraid of that.
I love it.
But they stick with it.
I love it.
You know,
I
keep wondering, we call him Jay, we call him Coach Wright, but Bones is the way to go. If you ever get
Bones.
My kids would love that.
Yeah, my kids would love that.
I'm surprised we have time after that introduction. I didn't think we'd have much time left on the calendar.
I know.
I was one of those people that needed no introduction, we would have been moving along here. But it was very nice. I appreciate it. No. I appreciate it.
All right, so let's get into this, because reading about you, learning about you is fascinating. You grew up in Bucks County. You were a fan of Villanova basketball.
Yeah.
You idolized Raleigh Massimino.
Yeah.
And then you basically, when you got into coaching, you practically snuck on into his camp.
Yeah.
You end up getting mentored by this same person.
Yeah.
And then as you went made your career, you came back to Villanova and won a champion. You love Villanova so much, you even married a Villanova cheerleader, coach.
I
so
did.
It's like a fairy tale. You manifested all of this. Tell us how you did it.
It's funny you mentioned about marrying a cheerleader. My wife is the same age as me. I'm 62. Our president, Father Peter Donahue, who you mentioned in the intro, is a very sarcastic individual and very funny. And he loves to say that I married a Villanova cheerleader, but he says it in a way as if she was 21 when I was like 55.
Right.
We met after she graduated from Villanova, and no one's ever explained it that way. I never thought of all of this manifesting the way it did. I really never thought of it that way. But Rolly Massimino, when I got into coaching, now before I got into coaching, he was one of my idols because I loved Villanova basketball as a kid. Mm-hmm. So I loved that team, and he was the coach. Jack Kraft was before him. But when I got into coaching, I started at the University of Rochester, Division III school. I did know that I wanted to work at that camp and learn under him. I never thought it would turn into working for him. I just thought, I'm going to learn. I'm going to go there, and I'm going to watch him. I'm going to listen to him, and I'm going to learn. And working at that camp actually helped me get the job there at Villanova as an assistant.
That's amazing. And you stuck onto it, right? I mean, basically, there was another team coming on board that you joined to get to the camp.
So at the time, Villanova used to bring in all these high school teams from all over the country, really. And I was an assistant coach at University of Rochester. And there were a bunch of teams from Long Island that were going down to the camp to be a part of the camp. They would go down as a team. And one of the coaches at Comsawag High School, his name's Frank Romeo. I still stay in touch with him to this day. He asked me, would you coach our team at the camp? So I thought, hell yeah, I'll coach the team because that's going to get me into that camp. Because at the time, Rolly Massimino was such a legend. Everybody wanted to work there, so you couldn't get on the staff. So I came in as a part of the high school team and coached his team in the camp. Then the next year, I got invited back as a staff member of the camp. But that's how I got in there.
I love that.
Good research.
I love it.
Good research.
I love it. All right, so I want to dive in. I want to dive into the first NCAA championship, okay? Take us back. Take us back to 2016. Chris Jenkins nails a buzzer-beating three-pointer to bring the Wildcats to an incredible victory over UNC, making it one of the most memorable finishes in NCAA championship history. So what were your immediate thoughts, your emotions in those final seconds when the team won, and how did you feel watching them celebrate?
Well, it's kind of bizarre. I got a lot of credit for being calm and reserved during that time because they replay that response I had. I'll tell you the truth about the response. But when we got, you celebrate, you go through everything, you're out on the court, you do your interviews, you do one shining moment, all that's all awesome. Then you finally get back to the locker room, which is like an hour later where it's just your team. And the players are saying to me, you're an OG, coach, you're an OG. I'm like, what are you talking about? They're like, you said bang when that shot went in. And I was like, what are you talking about? I never realized, but when they showed me the video of when the shot went in, I said bang, I realized that I always would say that in my mind in any game at the end of a shot clock. If we were taking the shot, I would just say to myself, as if I had any impact on the shot. I'm
going to
will it. I would say bang. I never knew my lips moved when I said that. Now, if the opponent was taking a shot with the shot clock going down or the game-ending shot and it was against us, in my mind, I would say, no bleep way.
Yeah.
I knew it. So thank God they never got my lips on that one, right? But it's a real interesting story about the end of that game. We had a 10-point lead with 3 minutes to go, and we really took pride in the fact that we did things the right way, and we executed properly. And with 3 minutes to go in the game, we started to crumble a little bit and started to do some things that were uncharacteristic. Mm-hmm. And I understood at that time, it was 80,000 people in the arena, first time in a national championship game. They're 18 to 22-year-olds, millions of people watching on TV. We started to crumble. So with 14 seconds left in the game, they had the ball and called timeout, and we were up three. Now, the only thing you can do in that situation, and we're in a huddle, is don't give up a three. You can foul. You can give up a two. You can do anything, but you can't give up a three. And everybody in basketball knows that. We gave up a three.
Right.
So with 4.7 seconds, they made a three, tied the game. So we really had crumbled.
Mm-hmm.
And that it looked like that game was going to go into overtime. And if it did, the momentum that North Carolina had going was probably looking like they were going to win that game.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, with 4.7 seconds in front of all those people with everything on the line, I was at half court. Our team was coming off the court. The rest of the team was coming off the bench to meet for a huddle. And they were all saying, attitude, attitude to each other.
Yeah.
And that's our mantra. So that's one of the things that I always want to teach our guys. We teach them through basketball that what you control in life is your attitude on the next play. Whatever happened on the previous play, you got to block that out of your mind, and you got to keep a fresh, clear mind to have a positive attitude on the next play. And we would practice that. Now, we wanted them to take that into life, that whatever happened on this past day, you start the next day, you have control of your attitude,
mm-hmm. right.
and you can have a positive attitude, and you control that. So I'm watching them after we had just crumbled, and I know that we look like we're choking, and all, both the guys on the court and the guys off the court are saying to each other, attitude. And I'm saying to myself, if they get this mm-hmm. now,
yeah.
with all of this on the line,
yeah.
and they get this concept for life, I'm good. If we lose, I'm good, because they're showing me something here that we want to, them to take into life. So we went into the huddle, and, you know, they continue. We got this attitude, guys, attitude. And that's our code word for, hey, we got to come out of this
with a
clear mind and a positive attitude. I knew we were going to execute the play properly because I knew they had a clear mind. I didn't know if the shot's going to go in. Mm-hmm. But I really was at the, like, I'm good with this. Like, these, I'm going to have a life lesson for them. Even if we lose this game, that your approach to controlling your attitude, 4.7 seconds and all that pressure, you just keep that for the rest of your life.
Right.
So then we hit the shot, and I was kind of like, hey, that's God's
will. Icing on the cake.
That's God's will, man. And then as soon as it went in, I kind of went like, that's God's will. And then Roy Williams was standing right next to me, and then I thought, man, that could be me.
Mm.
And I felt so bad for him.
Aww.
I was like, man, this could have gone the other way so easily, and it was going the other way.
You had that thought in the moment?
I did.
Wow.
And he's a good dude. And he really said, he goes, I'm really happy for you.
Yeah.
And then after that, my assistants jumped on top of me, and then we celebrated. But at the moment, that's what I was thinking. I was really thinking, like, they have a concept for life,
mm-hmm.
and they still do it, and they all do it. As we do this podcast, Colin Gillespie, one of our great guards who's playing in the Phoenix Suns organization, mm-hmm. just broke his ankle.
Mm.
And I called him and he said to me, attitude, coach, attitude. Like, what I control now going forward is my attitude in rehab.
Yeah.
And that's really what I was thinking about that time.
Such a rewarding thing.
Totally. And many of your players are now fathers themselves, right?
Yeah.
How often do you hear, I take the lessons that I learned from you on that mm-hmm. court to my parenting every day. I'm sure you hear that.
That's my favorite part of coaching, and what I've enjoyed the most in retirement is actually having the time for those authentic relationships, having those conversations.
Right.
When I was coaching, our former players would always come back, but I was always, I'd spend a little time with them, but I was always busy,
mm-hmm.
and I had our current team that I had to spend time with. But now, to actually spend more time with them and talk about those things, their children, their families, their careers outside of basketball, I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Well, so, all right, so this is one of the things that got me in your book, Attitude, is not just after that celebration, you brought the first championship back, the NCAA championship back to Villanova in 31 years. You're excited, you're elated, you just survived getting upset. Yeah. Right, you're in the locker room before the cameras all come in and the interviews start, and you said something to your players that I couldn't believe you had the presence of mind to say. Do you remember telling them how to think about the game?
There was a couple things. We first hold hands and we get ready to say a prayer. But me talking as much as I talk, even before the prayer, I got to say something. Because we have our team chaplain, Father Rob, says the prayer. So I can't keep it all in yet. So I said to them, two things I remember clearly. I don't know if this is what you're referring to, Doug, but I said, first, stone cutter. Remember the stone cutter, which is one of our sayings that we have in the locker room, which is if you look at a stone cutter tapping at a rock, he might tap at that rock 100 times and you might not see a crack, but on the 101st tap, that rock will crack. And it wasn't that 101st tap, but it was all that had come before. Mm-hmm. So I said to the guys, let's remember the stone cutter, which is all the guys that have come mm-hmm. before us that helped us build this. And then the other thing I said to them was like, this is great, and we're gonna celebrate this, and this is awesome, but let's make sure this doesn't define you mm-hmm. for the rest of it, that you do other great things in your life
yeah.
as fathers, as husbands, right. as parts of your community, and this isn't the best thing you do in your life.
Yeah,
that's just being a great coach.
It is.
Like, I think that's yeah. fantastic. Like, you can't help yourself.
Yeah.
You're wired,
you can't
that, help way.
Yourself. Wired
right?
that way. Yeah.
I gotta teach these guys a lesson. This is a lesson. It's like, hey, coach, let's just celebrate the win.
Yeah. So now I drive everybody around me crazy because I got to teach somebody something.
Hey, you know,
and I don't have a team anymore. So you guys are in trouble. We got to talk about something.
Get to it. Speaking
about the book attitude, one of the lines you say in there early on is, let's remember these are 18 to 20-year-old kids, 22-year-old kids. And that's a really important thing that, yeah, these people are still developing. They're still figuring things out. And you also have to have really difficult decisions or conversations with these folks.
Yeah.
Talk about redshirting, talking about injuries. Hey, you're not going to start. Hey, I know you're a senior, but you're going to play off the bench.
Yeah.
How do you have those difficult conversations, but yet still get them to buy into the core yeah. philosophy and the values?
I think it's the most important thing you do is develop relationship with your people. And it's the same in our businesses, right? It's the same in our relationships at UBS. You know, as leaders, we have corporate knowledge, we have experience, right? And they know that, but they don't care how much you know, and they don't care how much knowledge you're going to share with them until they know you care about them. Mm-hmm. So they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Yeah. And that's a big part of those conversations. And continually addressing difficult situations, because if you don't, they just get bigger mm-hmm. and bigger, and they get deeper and deeper. The mistrust gets mm-hmm. deeper,
yeah.
the hurt gets deeper, and it's hard to do, and it's actually exhausting. And it's one of the things that made me decide to retire is realizing I didn't have the energy for that. Mm. That I was starting to look at situations like, I was always most concerned about the unhappiest guys on the team. And, you know, think about that in our offices and our businesses.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the people that are really doing well and excelling, they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always somebody that's struggling in there, and they're going to have an impact on the team eventually. And it's kind of like your children. You're as happy as your unhappiest child, right?
Mm.
It's the same thing with your team.
Yeah.
And the people that you work with, they've got to know that you care about them when they're struggling. And the people that are having success, they're always watching your actions. You know, we had a saying that your actions speak louder than your words. So they're watching what you do. They might be doing well.
Mm-hmm.
They know someone on the team is struggling. And they're watching that you're spending time with that person. And they're thinking probably, you know what, that could be me mm-hmm. one day. So always addressing everything before it gets big, especially negative situations. So then when you do have to have a conversation about redshirting
mm-hmm.
or about, you've already been through other issues with them
yeah.
that maybe aren't as big, but they know you care.
Right.
And they know you have your best interest. You can't say it. You can't say, I care about you. I have your best interest at heart.
Yeah.
They're watching your actions and all of your decisions, and then they make their own decision whether you care or not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I want I want to go off script just for one second because because this is a podcast, right? I want to paint a picture for folks. I'm a little bit distracted to my left with this gigantic bling of jewelry on your hand, which is, I don't know if it's a championship ring or a Final Four ring or you have many of these rings. Do you have to do like finger exercises in the morning to keep this thing up? Because it is ridiculous.
This is
okay?
We should each get one for participation.
we should get a prize ring.
This is the 22 Final Four ring. And you know, one of the things we try, there's a lot of people that have this ring because we would say, you know, everyone's role is different, but everyone's status is the same. Mm. So again, we talk about your actions. Yeah. So when we won championships or went to Final Fours, I wanted rings for everybody. You know, janitor, bus driver.
It's fantastic. You know,
but
yes.
The school's got to pay for it, right? Yeah. They're like, whoa, we got to have some limits. I'm like, hey, if we say that everyone's role is different, but their status is the same, then everyone, managers, we got them for everybody. Because again, you talk about it's your actions that speak. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not. And so it was. Yeah. I know I'm retired now. They could probably admit it. I drove them crazy at Villanova with that because it cost them a lot. It cost them a lot of money.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so talk to us about the opportunities you had to coach in the NBA. We had the Sixers and the Knicks, but you chose to stay at Villanova. So what ultimately influenced this decision, and what did staying at Villanova mean to you personally and professionally?
Well, probably like you guys and like everybody in the business world, you have an idea of what is the path in my career. Mm-hmm. You know, what do the successful people in my career do? And who do I look up to? And, you know, in coaching, you look at the great successful coaches go on to coach in college, and then if they're really successful, they go to the NBA. And so in my mind as a young coach, I thought, well, that's the move, right? And there was a time at Villanova we went to a Sweet 16 or a Final Eight. I can't remember exactly what year it was. The first time we went to a Sweet 16 or Final Eight, I didn't go to Villanova with the idea that we're going to win championships. I went to Villanova with the idea that I am in charge of a great tradition that was better. It was great before I got there, mm-hmm. and it's going to be great when I leave. And this is my turn to be responsible for this great tradition. That's mm-hmm. what I thought of. And when we first got there, we were down a little bit, and we battled and battled like everybody does in building their business, right? And we got it to a place of great respectability. There was a number of opportunities with the NBA, but I was pretty sure we went to a Sweet 16. And I thought, we're back. You know, I've got this to a great level of respect, and this is where the tradition should be. And I feel good about what we accomplished, and we have it at a point where we can maintain this. And at the same time, the Sixers job opened. That was the one time, there was a number of other opportunities, but I really didn't take them serious. And Ed Stefanski, who you might know from our area, mm-hmm. Was the president, and I knew him well. Mm-hmm. And I thought, all right, Villanova's in a good spot. Mm-hmm. Ed Stefanski's in charge. I'll do this. And that's the next step. That's what I'm supposed to be. And then I thought, all right, I go there for 4 or 5 years ago, the NBA, you're getting fired. So then what would I want to do after I got fired? I'd probably want to coach Villanova. So I was like, well, then why would you leave?
Right.
Why would you? I mean, financially, you would leave. That would be the reason. But I just loved the connection at Villanova that we graduated all our student athletes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were all a part of the community. Everybody on campus, everybody in the community was committed to them being the best students, the best people, and the best players they could be. I love that mission. So I just thought, why? Just because that's what the world says your path is supposed to be.
Right.
Right.
If you really value what you're doing, and obviously we were okay financially. You didn't need to do it. But if you really value what you're doing and love going to work every day, don't give up on that. Don't mess with happy.
Right.
That's really what I thought about. And then every time after that, I reverted back to that decision.
Yeah.
Just said, I want to stay here.
Makes it easier for you.
Yeah. You knew it was right. You felt it, and that's what it was.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
That's good. So we had the opportunity to interview one of your former players, Randy Foy.
And oh, yeah.
In your book.
Awesome guy.
Exactly. You make it a point to talk about how great he is. And so I was at Penn in 05 when you guys were having success. You know, Fran Duffy was there, Phil Martelli, and you're having a lot of success.
When we first got there, Penn was really good and beat up on us in those early years.
You didn't want to say it, did you?
That was nice.
We only have so much time.
Take care of your guest. So we'll throw that in there, but go ahead, questions.
Well, so Randy is a great example, right, and that team of the Stonecutter philosophy that you mentioned. Like, where did you find that idea, and how did you say, hey, I'm going to use this in coaching?
Yeah. When we first got the job at Villanova, I always had great respect for Villanova that we talked about earlier, and one of the first things I wanted to do was I wanted to make the players aware of what I thought our responsibility was, just like, you know, you do with your team, right, and everybody at UBS does with their teams. I wanted our guys to understand that this program was great before you got here, and I brought all the guys into the arena, and I stood under the banners of the retired jerseys, and I said, do you know who Bill Melchione is? Do you know who Ed Pinckney is? Do you know who Kerry Kittles is? And they didn't. You know, they were young. It's not their fault, right? Young. They're 18, 19 at the time. So I explained to them all the great players and all the great teams and the tradition. And I wanted them to understand that we're all a part of something bigger than ourselves. And I also wanted them to understand that they were going to be, at some point, they were going to be the people that we're looking back on to show there were great players before you and that we're never going to forget you when you move on. And we had this rule that anybody that came into the practice facility, if you played at Villanova, you could come onto the practice court during practice and watch practice. But if you didn't play at Villanova, you weren't allowed on the court. Mm-hmm. So I always wanted our players to see the reverence that we treated the former players.
Yeah.
So that they understood that one day that would be them. Mm-hmm. They would never be forgotten. So when we won a championship, the guys like Randy Foy, he came in the beginning. He was one of those guys that I made stand under the banners.
Uh-huh.
He came in the beginning when it wasn't really cool to come to Villanova. He really trusted in us, and he set the foundation. And he took Villanova to the Final Eight.
Yeah.
Randy was national. He was Big East Player of the Year, first team All-American.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh pick in the NBA draft, but he didn't get to a Final Four, which was a dream. It didn't get to win a national championship. But I always wanted the players that are on national championship teams to know those were the guys that were tapping at the rock years and years before they got there. And we won championships, but we won championships because of the players on the current team, but because all the guys that tapped the rock years before them. And they were always going to be a part of that.
Tap the rock.
Randy was a big part of that.
Randy remains
a big part of that.
We like the guy.
Little known fact about Randy Foy, he wears Lululemons. He does. I asked him a TPQ tall person question. Where do you get your pants? And folks, he gets them at Lululemon. Where do you get your pants, Jay?
I wear some Lululemons myself. But why would you say it's a surprise for Randy? Because it's harder for taller people?
Well, because I personally live with giants, and I'm running out of options for them, right? So I'm like, where do we get our pants, man? Yeah, it was very helpful. So
see, I'm only 6'2", and I don't have to go to a tall man shop.
Yeah, I don't have that.
Randy's only 6'4". It's not that. We're going to another level with your guys.
I mean, I'm in another zone. Yes, I am. Yeah. Okay, so let's get back on track. So let's talk a little bit more about your book, Attitude. What inspired you to write this book, and were there specific moments or experiences that made you feel it was the right time to share this story?
That's an interesting question. I've read books of coaches that have won national championships. I enjoy it, but I always thought when we won the national championship, I didn't want to seem like, okay, now we won a national championship, now I got all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Me, who preaches humble and hungry all the time,
right.
We won the national championship, I thought, all right, that's cool. Now let's just keep getting better. Let's move on to the next year. Let's be humble and let's be hungry to get better. But other people started writing books about our, and people came to me and said, you should write a book.
Huh.
You can write a book. And I really didn't want to take the time, to be honest, to write a book.
Yeah, what do you have
but,
to do?
Right.
But they, other people were writing books about the season. And so people kept coming back to me and saying, like, that, the story of that season is going to be their story.
Right.
You're like, you need your story out there. The second thing was, our team chaplain's awesome guy, Father Rob Hagen. He's an amazing guy. And before every game, he would read a Bible verse and do a homily for our team. He would give it, and it was great. Like I would, he was so good. I would tell him, mm-hmm. like, Father, this is a big game. Don't make us cry before this game. He was so good. We'd have tears in our eyes. Oh. He was so motivating. He was amazing. And he would talk everything related to like where these young people were mm-hmm. in their lives. It wasn't all this like, you know, philosophical, religious stuff. It was really real life, spiritual stuff. And so for some reason, I think it was divine intervention, that year, I decided I'm going to take the scouting report for that game and I'm going to make notes of his homily on the back page of every scouting report for every game. So we played 40 games that year. I think we were 37-3. And I kept every homily notes and I had it on back of the scouting report. So I thought, great, here's our book, 40 chapters. Here's his lesson.
Yada, yada, yada.
Here's his lesson, and then we'll say what happened in the game.
Yeah.
And we were with the publisher, and he's like, yeah, this is really nice, but religion doesn't sell. No, we're not doing it. So as you've seen in the book, I mentioned Father Rob a lot, but Mike Sheridan, our sports information director, said, We can do this. He's a great writer. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'll sit with you and I'll interview you and then I'll transform everything you say, and then that's how we'll write the book. So that's how we did it, and it actually turned out really well because it was about the spirit of that team and some life lessons mm-hmm. in there. So I didn't make it. I hope I didn't make it sound like I got all the answers. Kind of showed the struggles that we went through, that everybody goes through, and that you can overcome them, and that you can remain humble
to
and
everybody.
Hungry.
The book can apply to anybody. You can give it to your kids. You can give it, you know, I've given it to mine.
Yeah. Read we're not paid to say that.
Yeah, no, we're not.
Have a good attitude, kids.
Yes.
I got that.
All right, one of my favorite stories from the book, the Hofstra story. It's earlier in your career, if I recall this correctly. You're sitting with a family, you're recruiting, and they say, well, aren't you going to get fired? And you kind of like brush it off in the meeting, and then afterwards you're talking to your assistant coach and saying, can you imagine they thought we were going to fire? And he's like, yeah, aren't we? Now, of course, you won back-to-back American East titles at that school, so like it was a good thing you
after
stuck
that,
around.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so that's an example of how laser-focused, completely optimistic you are.
Right.
And it's sort of like, you know, uncovered in history. So are there other examples like that where you're just so blindly optimistic?
That's a really interesting point because you guys are in your career. You've got a great career going with UBS, and you're right at that point where like you believe in yourself. There's some part of youth and inexperience, somewhat inexperienced what I was at that time, that you just don't know any better, and you just are so enthusiastic and positive. Mm-hmm. And to your point, Doug, really, it was a home visit with a young man in Queens. And what the mother said to me was, the coach that was in here before you is the coach at Boston University, who's also recruiting my son, said, if you don't win this year, you're getting fired. I was like, and I really was like, no, he's just saying that because he's recruiting against us. That's not true. And as you said, Doug, I said to Tom Pecora, my assistant, who's now the head coach at Quinnipiac, I said, can you believe, I was really naive. I said, can you believe he would say that we're going to get fired? He goes, we are getting fired. and it was the first time it really hit me.
Yeah.
But I think then when I moved on to Villanova and it, after our first 2 years didn't go real well, going into our third year, people were saying you get fired. But I remembered if you don't have a good year this year, you're going to get fired. I had there was a sports writer, Dana O'Neill, who wrote for the Philadelphia Daily News at the time, she met me at a diner and said, I have to write this article, right? And she's like, I got to write an article that if you don't win this year, you're getting fired. I said, I know, I get it. But what I've taken from that is, if we, once you get experienced and you realize you really could have gotten fired and you were close, or you get fired, you kind of lose that youthful enthusiasm and positivity. Mm. And I think it's a challenge for all of us not to lose that.
Yeah.
Right? No matter, with more and more experience, you gain wisdom, but you gotta find a way to keep that youthful, positive intellect, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. That at the time it came from naivete, mm-hmm. when at that time of the story you told. But as I got older and I had some wisdom and experience, I tried to always reach back for that and say, like, that's my attitude that I choose to have. Like, I just think we're going to do it, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be positive about it. And I used to always tell our players, don't worry about things happening in the future, because mm-hmm. yeah. most times the things you worry about never happen. And then the things that you never thought of happen.
Right.
Right? So that's where you keep that.
That's how it works in the markets.
Yeah.
All the things you're looking at are not what gets you.
Yeah. Right? And so to worry about it is a waste of time. You got to keep that youthful optimism, and that's your attitude. That's what you control.
Well, so let's talk about passing on that knowledge. You are a Bucknell University grad. Go Bison.
Yeah, man.
Graduated class of 83, and 40 years later, you stood on the podium, you gave the commencement speech to the class of 2023, and you said, quote, "Our challenge team is to create your own basic core values, dare to be different, create your own path and core values that are uniquely yours." Tell us what that experience was like to go back to the podium 40 years later talking about core values.
That was a thrill of a lifetime, an honor of a lifetime to go back to your university. I was an average student at best there, so I had about 12 of my fraternity brothers that showed up. They're like, "I have to see this to believe it. I can't believe they're letting this guy speak on commencement." Literally, they were all there, and we went out to dinner the night before, and you know, I said to my guys, "I'm speaking tomorrow morning. This can't be like one of our old get together nights. This has got to be cool tonight." They were all very respectful, so we all grew and developed some wisdom, but. Jess, to your point and what I was trying to make to the students at Bucknell, which was kind of what we were talking about with that youthful optimism, is mm-hmm. I learned, and man, talk about the markets being similar to this. You have no control, really, of the results of the market, of your investments. You don't have control. Anything in the world could happen and affect that, right? What you control is how you live every day, how you approach your work every day, your attitude, your work ethic. That's what you control, right? And then how you live and how you evaluate yourself comes from your core values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now it took me some time to develop that as a coach, but I, like, our core values as a coach was play hard, together, smart, and with pride. But we wanted to live that way. Like, live hard, give your best effort, everything you do. Live together with others, think of others. Live smart, be a lifetime learner. And take pride in what you're a part of, your family, your community,
yeah.
UBS, not your personal, individual accomplishments. So, and that's how you should evaluate yourself. Like, am I giving my best effort? Am I thinking of others?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Am I trying to learn and always get better? And am I thinking and working for my team and my family and not myself individually? So I was trying to explain to them, develop that, whatever that core value is for you,
mm-hmm.
right? We developed that for our players, for our team, but we wanted them to take that individually into life.
Right.
And have that as a way you evaluate yourself, not how the world evaluates you as, like, what kind of car do you drive? What kind of bling do you wear? You know, what kind of clothes do you wear? Don't use that as your evaluation of success.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Well, I mean, so in your history of being a head coach, you often refer to yourself as a CEO. And it's true. You have scouting. You go home and you watch the games with your wife, Patty.
Yeah.
You have to fundraise. You have all these responsibilities. You even have a radio show, right? A weekly radio show.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that you're not doing all that, Yeah. Are you surprised by how much time you have on your hands?
I am. It's unbelievable how much time I have. And what's starting to hit me now is when I get into, and I'm in a week like this right now, where I'm going from one thing to another, which is I don't do it as much anymore. But when I catch a week like that, and I'm going from one thing to another, like we have some things going on at Villanova. We're hiring some important people, so we're doing interviews. And then we've got this, we're working with UBS today. And then we got a game, Villanova game. And so you're going from one thing to another. I can't believe I did that every day of my life for all those years. You guys are in it right now. You're doing it. Yeah. And I watch people like you just go from one thing to another and work. And then your family, take care of your family, and then up early the next day. After I do it for a week, then I take a couple days. Yeah. I take a couple days off, and I just think, I never took these days, ever.
Yeah.
So that's what really amazes me, is that I look back and just, and I look at people that are doing that job. Like, I look at Kyle Neptune now, and, you know, I'll be at a practice, and then I'll go home and have dinner with Patty, and he'll call me, and I'll say, where are you? Because I'm driving down to D.C. recruiting. And then I think, that used to be me. Yeah. That's where I would be. I just watch practice. I'm exhausted and hungry. I want to have dinner. He's driving to D.C. Yeah. That used to be me.
That was you. Oh, my gosh. Well, so I do want to make sure that I talk about your work with UBS, right? So as I mentioned in the intro, you're part of UBS's America's Advisory Council. Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your role in the council.
The reason I joined the council is a relationship with Dwayne Hughes. Mm-hmm. And Brian Hull.
We love Dwayne.
We love Dwayne.
And I love their, he and Brian Hull and have a commitment here, and as everyone does at UBS, and this is what excited me about being a part of the UBS family, of creating a culture that everyone that comes to UBS and is a part of the UBS team feels like they are getting better at what they do, and they're growing, and they have opportunities by being a part of this UBS team. And it's exactly what we always try to do with our team. We tried to teach our guys the concept of team, which I think in today's world, there's young people are taught how to brand themselves individually. Mm-hmm. They're not taught the value of being a part of the mm-hmm. team. And how that can help you individually.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can actually become the best version of yourself by giving yourself to a team if that team is committed to helping you grow while the team grows, if that team is committed to helping you grow individually and providing opportunities for you to grow and inspiring and mentoring you to grow, then by being a part of the team, you actually will be more successful and will get further than if you would just gone out on your own and just tried to be your best by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that UBS has that philosophy, and I love being a part of it. So we talk to teams mm-hmm. like your team and about that concept of the value of being a part of something bigger than yourself. And when you are the leader, like you are, Doug, in that team, that you have a responsibility of mentoring and providing opportunities for all of your people to grow also. Mm-hmm. So that's what we believe in here at UBS, and I love being a part of it.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool organization, I will say. And I was not paid to say that.
Okay.
So tell me, what have you learned the most about yourself since you stepped away from coaching?
As we were talking about earlier, how insanely obsessed I was with our team and making each individual guy better.
Mm-hmm.
And I really never cared about wins and losses. I didn't like to lose, obviously, but it was always the commitment to our team growing and each individual guy becoming the best version of himself. And it was every day, all day. Like, I would be sitting in church and the priest would be giving a message or doing a Bible reading, and I would grab my phone and text one of my players, like, I just heard this. This is good for you. My wife would smack me. But it was just always on my mind. And I remember saying to them, when I would talk to the team sometime, I would say to them, you guys don't realize I'm thinking about you all the time, and I'm always trying to think of ways to make you better. And I would say that to him, but I never thought about how crazy that was when I wasn't with them and my poor wife and kids dealing with that.
Yeah.
Because now that I don't have that responsibility, I have such a free mind to be open to other things and enjoy my relationship with UBS. And I'm assistant to our president, you know, doing things with the business school and the athletic department, all the other, and being able to golf and spend time with my family, all those other things. I didn't realize how much, how obsessed I was.
Right.
Although I loved every minute of it.
Are you still obsessed? Do you still watch every game?
No, I'm not.
Interesting.
I'm not.
Interesting.
And I enjoy, I mean, I do watch every game, but I'm not, I can let it go.
Yeah.
You know, when I was coaching, it was either we lost and I wanted to fix it and I was obsessed until we fixed it, or we won and I was on to the next game.
Yeah.
It was constant. It was never, there was never a time off. And now I go to the game, I feel bad after the game if we lose.
Yeah.
I'm happy if we win, but then I can go on to something else that night.
Oh, my God.
And it's unbelievable. And I can watch, you know, working for CBS, and doing the color commentary or being in the studio, I can look at the game as a fan. Like, I would watch every game and think, if I saw a good team, I would think to myself, we could play them in the NCAA tournament. How are we going to watch a game and think, like, how are we going to stop that team?
Yeah.
And then I'd be going to sleep thinking, like, we could run into Kansas in the Sweet 16, and I just watched them run a play that we can't stop. So I was always thinking about that, where now I watch it and say, like, hey, that was a pretty good play. Kansas looked good tonight. I can say something on TV tomorrow about what a great job Bill Self's doing coaching the team.
Yeah.
And it's really enjoyable.
Do you ever watch Villanova games and you think, not sure why they did that. Why did they do that way?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. But, it's like...
not my circus, not my monkey.
Yeah. And it's like watching your own kids.
Right.
You know, you watch your own kids play, and you're like, why is that coach doing that? And you got to think to yourself, well, he or she is volunteering her time. That's their relationship. You got to let them do it. And it's really the same thing now with me. Like, I do know at our level of coaching, and this is something I try to relate to fans when I do TV, if a coach is making a decision and you think he or she should do something else, they've already thought of that, and they've made the decision to not do that, and they're willing to take the hit and the criticism if it doesn't work. They're already ahead of you, and you're complaining about them. They already know you're going to complain about them.
Yeah.
So I have empathy more. I see maybe they'll do something like, why did they do that? But in my mind, I'm like, I know there's a reason, and I'm not responsible for it anymore.
Yeah.
So I got to let it go.
Yeah. I have another question. I'm going off script. I'm just thinking of these questions. So there are a lot of parents out there who have young kids who might want to play basketball. It seems like there's a lot of pressure to do all the teams and all the club teams. And you okay?
Yeah.
Okie dokie. And so my question is, what advice would you give parents or with these kids who just seem so stressed out trying to get to the best team or get to Division I or to appease their parents?
Yeah. This is hard for parents to understand because they're so invested.
You hear this, Jess? Are you listening?
And
get her a pen.
It is hard. And I would try to tell our players this. Look, your parents love you. Like, you are the most important thing in their life. So they don't have the responsibility, though, of getting you to the next level. I'm your coach. Like, I have to teach you and make you do things that you don't want to do to get you where you want to go. They just want to love you up.
Yeah.
And so I know when we lose a game or you don't play well, I know that your mom blames it on me. I know that. But just so you know, my mom watches the games. She blames it on you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, we all have moms and dads, and that's a good thing. We need that love, but they're not the people that are going to get you where you want to go in terms of sports. You got to listen to your coaches. Now, as parents, that's hard to do. But the one thing I would say to the parents is the best thing you can do for your child is talk to them about how you evaluate them and how you want them to compete. Mm. And you say to them, I'm going to evaluate you by your effort, right, and by your attitude, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. that's what you control. You don't control the other players on your team, the other boys or girls that play with you. You don't have control of them. You don't have control of your coach. You don't have control of the referee. We're going to talk after every game or practice about, did you give your best effort, mm-hmm. and did you have a positive attitude? Now, you're not going to be perfect, but just address it and mm-hmm. say, like, look, remember on this play right here, you didn't, if you're playing soccer, like, you didn't run down the wing. Now, you're mad that you didn't get enough shots on goal, but you didn't run hard enough on that play. That you control. Yeah. Or, you know, the referee made a call, and you had your head down for the next 30 seconds. You didn't make any plays. Like, that's your attitude. You control that. You got to have a positive attitude.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then, obviously, hey, remember when your teammate lost the ball and you went over and patted her on the back and said, don't worry about it? Like, that's a positive attitude. That's
yes.
the stuff. Like, address that stuff because yeah. that's what they control.
So let's stay on that topic because you're the son of a coach, right? Yeah. And you have three children that are the sons yeah. and daughter of a coach. You think that's hard to do when you have somebody who's accustomed to giving you direct feedback? And you think yeah. it's hard to be the child of a coach?
Definitely. Yeah. Especially when they were younger, my kids were around, especially in basketball, were around a lot of great players and a lot of coaching. And they probably did know a little bit more when they were younger than their coaches. Mm-hmm. And they would come back and say, like, Dad, he doesn't know what he's doing. And I would say, like, that's your coach. It doesn't matter.
Do you ever want to step in? I just kind
of
know.
I mean, maybe a little bit, but not much, because I really did believe in the fact that their ability to deal with that situation where maybe the coach didn't know as much as them, but suck it up, have a positive attitude.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine
give
being
great
this
effort.
Guy's
you gotta be zen.
The coach of this guy's
yeah, yeah.
kids?
That's Ooh. Tough.
And what's funny is my oldest, who was the worst in terms of attitude, and he was good in effort, but attitude, he would have a bad attitude. Is now a coach.
Hmm.
He's a high school coach. And he,
wow. a third generation.
Through his career, he wound up being a minor league baseball player, but that wound up being his strength when he was playing minor league baseball. He was a closing pitcher,
mm-hmm.
and he had the greatest attitude. Like, he could come in at the end of the game, mm-hmm. tie game, bottom of the ninth, and handle that situation.
Yeah.
But when he was young and he was in high school, he was not great at that.
Yeah.
But that's what we always would preach to him.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is he had great competitiveness. And my wife used to say to me all the time, hey, like, you know, his competitiveness is crazy. And I would say, like, that's something you can't teach. Like, that's something good to have. Like, he'll grow out of that. But we control his attitude and his effort. And let's just concentrate on that.
Yeah.
You mentioned your wife, Patty. Can we give a round of applause to Patty? She watches every
Snaps
game.
For Patty. Snaps.
Saints.
She watched the game with you. Did she watch the actual live game and then watch the replay with you?
Yeah, but she would. It's legend. It's a legend in our household. We win or lose, you know, she'd wait for me after the press conference. We'd always walk back from the press conference together because she's always my guiding light. You know, my barometer. You know, she would say, like, she said, you know, you said this in the press conference. That might not have come across the way you wanted to. She's always right. She's smart. She's a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
she was always great for me that way. Or, you know, you yelled at this guy. You yelled at this kid during a game. He was crushed. Like, you don't know the impact you had on him. But she would say, oh, I can't wait to go home and watch the film. Because I would always go home and watch the film. Working for Rolly Massimino, after every game, we would go back to his house. His wife would cook pasta. We'd drink wine. We'd have tons of people there. And it would drive me crazy because I wanted to watch the game.
Yeah.
Which he would the next morning, but that was his thing.
Yeah.
And I always said, if I get to be a head coach, I'm watching that film right after the game.
Yeah.
And so I would always go back and watch the game. She'd always say, oh, I can't wait to go back and watch the film. We'd both get a glass of wine, put the game film on. 2 minutes into the game, she'd be out. She'd be out every single time. She'd like wake up with like 2 minutes left. She's like, are we still winning? It was every time. But she would still say, I can't wait to go home and watch the film.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, I want to make sure that we get our signature questions out to Jay. Before we ask the signature questions, best Philly cheesesteak.
Oh, that's a good one. My favorite, it's a place people probably haven't heard of them, Chubby's. Chubby's.
Ooh. Where's Chubby's?
Chubby's is in Manayunk.
Oh, Chubby's about to get blown up.
Chubby's is in Manayunk.
You heard it here first, folks.
It is a great spot. It's right across the street from D'Alessandro's, which is very good.
Yeah.
D'Alessandro's is very good, but it's across the street. It's so good. One time on Christmas Eve, we went and did a charity thing in Philly. And our family was coming back on Christmas Eve to go back to our house. We go, where do you want to go out to dinner? We're like Chubby's. We were Chubby's on Christmas Eve.
Oh, my God.
We love it.
All right.
Not the seven fishes. What?
Exactly. Just a cheesesteak, a new tradition, yeah. Okay, so our signature question is, can you tell us what your earliest memory surrounding money is?
My wife is the business mind in our family. Mm-hmm. Patty runs our finances, and I remember when I was at Hofstra, we got our first raise, and you guys would appreciate this being from South Jersey. If you grow up in Philly, like, your dream is to have a place at the Jersey Shore, right?
Oh, yeah.
So all I ever wanted was a place at the Jersey Shore. I didn't care what it looked like. I just wanted to be able to go there and have my own spot and not rent, which we always did. So we had our first raise at Hofstra. We weren't making a lot of money at all. And we got a raise. So I thought we got a raise. And I'm like, can we get a house at the Jersey Shore? She's like, no, we can't afford the house we live in right now. We can't get a house at the Jersey Shore.
I love it.
So every time we would get another raise, I'm like, can we get a house at the Jersey Shore? She's like, no, we're not even close. So finally, so at Hofstra, we could never afford one. At Villanova, when we made it to the Sweet 16 the first time, we got a bonus, and I looked at her, and I was like, bonus.
Is it
Jersey
time?
Sure. She goes, we can do it. Yes. We can do it. So that was my.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But I always would tell our guys, like, if you don't come from money, you don't understand the value of money. You know, even when you get a lot of it, you don't understand that it's not as much as you think, right? And you've got to have somebody intelligent, like from UBS, that's going to guide you and help you, unless that's something that you grew up with your whole life and knew about. Like, you really need guidance and great advisors like you guys. Yeah. And I always would tell my guys that, like, if someone's coming to you right away with ideas to invest your money, let's see if they come up with an idea for you, for them to invest with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, these outs as separate from advisors, because our guys would have all these people come to them with ideas. Let an advisor who is concerned with you and a long-term relationship, let them be the ones to advise you.
I love it. So we should really ask Patty what money means to her. We get that
exactly.
Lesson. There's a deep, deep talk there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I got one more question. I guess we'll just finish it out. March Madness. You've been consumed by it for all these years.
Yeah.
Now that you're running around, can you enjoy it? Is it fun? Do you fill out a bracket?
Man, I do. I do now.
All
I do.
Right.
And our family always filled out the bracket, but you had to pick Villanova to go all the way through.
Natural.
So we had a family bracket. And I would just throw mine together because I was always so busy. But now for CBS, we have to fill one out early. So I do, and then I make that my family bracket too. But what has been so, I think you asked me a question earlier about, like, what have you learned about yourself since you retired? One of the things that amazed me about working for TNT and CBS during the NCAA tournament is it's such an incredible event. And I think it's the greatest sporting event in our country. It brings the whole country together for 3 weeks.
And it
brings together people with local pride.
Yes.
You know, even if they didn't go to the school, if that school's in their area and it's going to the Sweet 16, everybody's behind them.
Even people that don't necessarily watch basketball know what's going on.
During that time.
Even volleyball people. Yes.
But doing the NCAA tournament, I realized that every year that you're in the NCAA tournament, you lose. You lose every year. Now, we were fortunate 2 years that we won the whole thing, but I was in it for like 40 years. Yeah. You lose every other year, and you are tortured by that loss, and you can't watch the tournament. If you lose in the second or first round, you can't watch basketball for 2 weeks. It just kills you.
Oh, yeah.
So the first time I did it for TV and went all the way through and did the tournament and never lost, I was like, this is really cool.
Yeah.
I was never worried about losing. I made it all the way through. And it's over, and I didn't lose.
Yeah.
This is cool. And I get to do this again next year and go all the way through. It was a thrill. I love doing the NCAA tournament. It's awesome.
We're getting the high sign. We got to let you go. But we want to say thank you, Coach. Thank you
this
for stopping by.
Great being with you.
Wonderful.
Great being with
best.
You.
Best. Thanks for stopping by. Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you, Coach Jay. Doug, was that not the coolest experience?
Listen, it was very cool. I'm thinking about this. You know, we got football players and basketball players. Can we get like a jockey or like a high school student or like a middle school student?
You
that
want
I'm
someone
than?
To relate to?
I need to be like, I mean, all these impressive people.
Listen, I cannot believe that we just spent the last hour with the legendary Jay Wright. I hope all of our stopping by listeners tune in, right? Find us on Spotify, find us on Apple Podcasts, stopping by Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS.
And if you like what you see, don't keep us a secret.
Share
it. Get it to people. Get it in the hands.
Share the love. Spread the love. Share the love. And thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for stopping by.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.